Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 73 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or join the discussion there. Follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. You can download the show after it airs at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on iTunes and other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. Send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show. And if you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. Now for the feedback of the week. Dale from Ontario, Canada said, "I really like your Infectious Myth program. You continue to present many interesting and important topics for discussion that otherwise are ignored by the media and unknown to the general public. I applaud your commitment and courage." Thanks for those kind words, Dale. And if people have ideas for other guests or other topics that, as Dale has noticed, are ignored by the media and unknown to the general public, please let me know. I'm always interested in talking to new people, and probably half the guests I've had on my show are people that I'd never heard of until they were brought to my attention by a listener. So this week I'm going to be on my own. I want to talk about Robert Gallo and his 1984 AIDS papers, but first let's go through some of the recent news and current events. Let's start by talking about Planned Parenthood. I listened to some snippets of the congressional hearing, which was obviously trying to put Planned Parenthood out of business. It's become kind of a Republican initiative. Somehow it's going to solve all the world's problems. To start, I'd like to say that I support a woman's right to control her reproduction through birth control and abortion. It's nice if a woman is in a situation where consulting with others, such as a partner or husband or whatever, about her decisions is comfortable, but many women aren't in a situation like that. Ultimately, they need to be the ones to decide whether they're going to use birth control, whether they're going to have an abortion. It's not really for a bunch of old men in society to make that decision for them, which is what some people seem to want to have happen. Listening to the congressional hearing was painful because the Republicans talked over the Planned Parenthood president and even outright lied, presenting numbers they said came from organizations, from the Planned Parenthood organization, but that actually came from an anti-abortion organization. And don't get me started on presidential candidate Carly Fiorina, who dreamt up a part of the video nobody else saw in which a perfectly formed baby is sawn open by the Planned Parenthood vivisectionists. But I find it ironic that Planned Parenthood defends themselves on the basis of activities that are questionable, such as encouraging women to have mammograms. Planned Parenthood doesn't do these themselves, but refers women routinely for mammograms, presumably with the cost covered by donors or government programs. Planned Parenthood is a health provider, basically of last resort, to Americans who don't have insurance, because it often doesn't charge for its services. I don't know if they ever charge for their services. So they perform an important charitable function, but it includes these things like mammograms that our guests, Peter Gottschy, in episode number 3, and in his many papers and other public statements, have shown are useless and probably counterproductive. Planned Parenthood also does syphilis screening. I haven't had an episode of The Infectious Myth on syphilis, but this, like HIV, is based on an antibody test, which is hugely flawed, like HIV, and I have investigated the history of syphilis, and people need to ask some pretty big questions before they go for a syphilis test. I can't say anything about the other types of STD testing that Planned Parenthood does. This is not really a criticism of Planned Parenthood. They're really just a victim of the medical establishment. They follow standard procedures. And many, just because many of those will be abandoned in future years doesn't mean that they're going to step out of line now. And in fact, Planned Parenthood would have a really difficult time doing anything really innovative or questioning of the medical establishment because they're under so much fire. And they don't promote mammograms any more than any other organization. It's just that everybody accepts that they're valuable because, of course, cancer screening is a good thing, even though it's not. Here in Canada, abortion, like gay marriage, has been delegalized for years. It's a word I made up. By that, I mean that the laws to restrict it were overthrown and they weren't replaced. And the streets are not flowing with the blood of aborted fetuses. Women have access to abortion in most parts of Canada when they decide to use the service. Since most couples, including a lot of gay couples, see raising a child as a physical expression of their love, something they really want to do, even if women do have an abortion when they are, say, too young, too economically insecure, or for other reasons, decide to have an abortion at one point in time, that doesn't mean that they won't have a child later. It doesn't make them incapable of loving a child any more than a woman who never did have an abortion. My wish, actually, is that the U.S. government would fund abortions for poor women via Planned Parenthood or any other organizations, and that Planned Parenthood would stop recommending mammograms and syphilis screening. They should take a critical look at the science instead of using published recommendations and standard procedures, and we've always done it that way as crutches. But then the same goes for just about every other medical organization in America. So it's not really criticism of Planned Parenthood. I just find it kind of ironic that their defense is to emphasize the things that probably have less value than the provision of contraceptive and abortion services. Let's move on to the Roseburg and Umpqua shootings. I was driving back from a bike trip last week. I'd ridden down the coast of Oregon and part of California with my daughter, when a police car raced up behind me, lights flashing. I pulled over to the right-hand side of the road, ready to get a speeding ticket or something like that, even though I didn't really think I was speeding. But the police car just shot past and disappeared. I didn't think anything more of it for a while, but later I turned on the radio out of boredom because I was driving for 6 or 7 hours to get back to Portland, Oregon. Out in the middle of nowhere, there was only one radio station that appeared to be available, and it was talking about the latest mass shooting in Southwest Oregon. Wait a minute, I thought. I'm in Southwest Oregon. Oh, well, Southwest Oregon's a big place. I can't really be anywhere close to anything out of the ordinary happening. But then they mentioned Roseburg, and almost at the same moment, I saw a sign for a turn off to Roseburg. And then I crossed the South Umpqua River. Actually, I think it was in the opposite order. While they were mentioning the Umpqua Community College, and then finally the turnoff to the Umpqua Community College. I'm not trying to insert myself into the story. I didn't stop, and I didn't see anything but a bunch of black SUVs with flashing lights heading south from Portland to Roseburg. But this brought to mind the interview with Adam Lankford at the Infectious Myth, episode 69. Once again, the perpetrator was a socially isolated young man. But here we run into trouble with the positive predictive value. Even if the risk factors were identified ahead of time, there are probably thousands or tens of thousands of men like that. No success at school, no social skills, so no friends, no girlfriend, no job or a dead-end job. But we cannot ignore that he acquired 14 guns, something that probably would be impossible in other countries. As Adam Lankford showed, the number of mass shootings grows predictably with the number of guns that are available in the population. But we can't throw people into protective custody for simply being a, quote, loser. I don't like to use that term because nobody is hopelessly lost. They can all be recovered if they want to recover and if there are people there to help them. Society should do a lot more to help these young men find meaning in their life, through work, through education, through volunteer activities. There's a human being in there somewhere. Ironically, it seemed that the Umpqua College shooter was trying to do exactly Ironically, it seemed that the Umpqua College was trying to do exactly that. It was trying to help young men and also anybody else find meaning in their life. In a depressed area of the country, people were trying to better their skills, learn how to work in vineyards as grape growing is becoming more of a thing in that part of the country, become a teacher, things like that. And that's what the shooter chose to attack. Maybe chose is the wrong word, because his choice of idolizing Nazis in the IRA didn't seem terribly thoughtful. He was supposedly anti-religion, but then the IRA were involved in a religious war, the IRA supposedly protecting the Catholics against the Protestant colonizers. Although the IRA wasn't a particularly religious group, the people in the IRA were all Irish Catholics. I think, like so many of the other shooters, there was just a desire to blame others for his problems and seek revenge for his perceived lack of success, rather than asking himself how he could be more successful by changing his life. But why does a country let people have weapons that appear to have no real function except killing lots of other people? It's like the gun manufacturers are optimizing their weapons to make frustrated people feel powerful. A feeling of power that lasts only a few seconds or minutes. I imagine that for a while these shooters feel like the king of the world, seeing people who ignored or even despised them before, now suddenly cowering in terror. Of course, it is only a few minutes, because then he's faced with a choice of suicide, which they usually take, dying in a hail of bullets, or rarely, as the shooter in Charleston, surviving to be charged with mass murder in court, and possibly facing the death penalty in the United States. Another thing that's rarely mentioned is the use of psychotropic drugs and how those can cause psychotic behavior. And again, this shooter in Roseburg, Oregon, was mentioned to have had been suffering from mental illness for a long time, which strongly suggests he was on psychoactive drugs. And there were references on his Facebook page that somebody captured before it was taken down to him having a bunch of pills, and he was just going to take four of each pill because he couldn't remember which one was which. Now, for a third news item, and there's a bit of a preamble here before I get to the actual news item, but I've been thinking for a while that we're running into problems with the question of sexual consent and generally using the laws of fraud around that. Clearly, everybody wants sex to be consensual, but if consent is redefined in a very legalistic fashion, you get some unintended consequences. For example, somebody who is HIV antibody positive, even if they don't believe in the HIV tests and are perfectly healthy, can be charged with sexual assault or rape after having consensual sex if they don't reveal their status. This is often based on the laws of fraud. It was consensual sex, but if you obtain the consent under fraud, then it's no longer consensual, and non-consensual sex is sexual assault or rape. I suppose if you believe HIV is a deadly virus, this makes sense. But if that's the case, what about other deadly viruses such as human papillomavirus, HPV, syphilis, or even influenza? Why are these criminal cases always about HIV and not about other viruses or pathogens? Why is this logic about sexual consent with viruses applied only to HIV and not in other cases? If sex with fraudulent consent is truly taken to an extreme, we would have a situation where a Jewish woman willingly has sex with a man she believes is Jewish, finds out later he is Arab, decides she wouldn't have had sex with him if she'd known, and has him charged with rape. But this is not a hypothetical. This actually happened in Israel, and the man was convicted of rape. So let's take other circumstances. What if the man says he's rich, but he's really poor? Or says he's single, but he's married? Or says he's Catholic, but he's not? Or vice versa? Or insists that he's fertile when he knows very well that he's not? I think we could think of a thousand things that if you knew about a guy would turn you off. Perhaps most young men looking for sex without strings attached in a bar on a Friday night are lying about something. But I mentioned men. This also applies to women. Women may also lie about being married, about whether they have any kids, about their religion, about just about anything. And does that make them rapists? This whole notion of consent gets a bit absurd. So let's get back to reality, which is sometimes more absurd than absurdity. A woman named Gail Newland in the United Kingdom found a woman friend attractive, so she created a male online personality, and gradually the online relationship became more intimate to the point where they agreed to meet. But Gail, pretending to be a man, insisted that her partner wear a blindfold and used a dildo to penetrate the other woman during sex. She gave some story about being disfigured from cancer surgery and therefore she couldn't let her lover see her. They met and had sex about 10 times before the woman, Gail's partner, who's unnamed, the one not pretending to be a man, ripped off her blindfold and realized that not only was she having sex with a woman, but a woman who she knew quite well. It was a friend of hers. This went to court, and Gail Newland was convicted and will soon be sentenced, probably to a very significant jail term, for multiple counts of sexual assault. This again relies on the idea of fraudulent consent. While Gail Newland disputes a lot of the facts of the case, and she says that it was actually a consensual lesbian relationship, if we take the conviction at face value and the statements of the judge, it's true that her lover would have rejected her if she had come on to her as a lesbian. The question is whether this is criminal behavior or not. As one LGBTQ commentator noted, the sex was good enough that they both came back for more, so what was the harm? Ironically, Gail Newland could have protected herself by stating that she felt she was a man in a woman's body. Then she could argue that she believed herself to be a man, and since we are all allowed to choose our gender identity, then she wouldn't have been impersonating a man, and therefore the consent wouldn't have been fraudulent, and the charges would have fallen. And I'm not just making this up. I was listening to two quite intelligent commentators talk about this idea seriously. I expect to be commenting on more and more situations like this. In our worthwhile desire to ensure that all sex is good and consensual, we could be uncovering the injustices that our desire to legalize human behavior always produces. And as the Gail Newland case reinforces, women are putting themselves at risk by insisting on an extreme legalistic interpretation of sexual consent. I expect things to get worse before they get better, and people like Gail Newland could spend a decade or so in jail before we decide that the legal system shouldn't be involved in people's sexual lives unless true coercion is involved. Not necessarily physical coercion, it could be economic or social or some other type. But real coercion, not simply the lies that wannabe lovers tell each other. And finally on this subject, I'm just waiting for the first situation where a woman who is slightly inebriated lays a complaint against a man she had sex with, and the man turns around, points out that he was even more drunk, and lays a complaint against her. Is it possible that both sexual partners could be convicted of sexually assaulting each other? That both could be the victim and the attacker? Well, that gets me to what I really wanted to talk about today, which was Robert Gallo's 1984 papers that established the theory that HIV causes AIDS, established them as a fact in the minds of most people, in particular politicians and the press and the medical community. These 1984 papers, although they're more than 30 years old, are very, very important. In a 1996 book called Impure Science, AIDS Activism and the Politics of Knowledge, Stephen Epstein discusses how HIV/AIDS went from hypothesis to certainty in the published scientific record from 1984 through 1986. He examined causal claims that referenced certain seminal papers, mostly the 1984 papers by Robert Gallo. He categorized claims that HIV causes AIDS as using these 1984 Gallo papers and others as either one, explicit and unqualified, no doubt expressed, two, implicit and unqualified, no doubt but causation is only implied, three, qualified, some doubt expressed, e.g. HIV, the virus believed to cause AIDS, and four, doubt, explicitly stating that the virus may not be the cause. And he looked at the number of papers in 1984 that used explicit, unqualified statements to talk about the association between HIV and AIDS, and there were only 3.4% In 1985, it was 24.5%, and by 1986, it was 62%. Those who gave qualified support for the hypothesis, for example, they said the virus believed to cause AIDS, those went from a 58% in 1984 and 1985 to 21% in 1986. So here we see over a two-year period how the belief in HIV and AIDS was strengthened. But Epstein notes that even when the only papers that were cited were the 1984 Gallo set of four papers, the statistics still hold. And this is basically true today. People will revert the 1984 Gallo papers if you push hard enough, because basically nobody has tried to make these claims ever since then. The only other person who made similar claims was Luc Montagnier, and he admitted, among other things, that he never purified the virus, which is still a really big open question. Well, before we talk about the papers, we need to go through the timeline. The difference between April and May of 1984 doesn't seem very big now, but it is very important. The sequencing is very important. First, Gallo and his team patented the blood test on April 23rd, 1984. Later that same day, the head of U.S. Health and Human Services, Margaret Heckler, who had our esteemed Dr. Gallo at her side, announced that HIV, then called HDLV-3 by Gallo, was the probable cause of AIDS. And it wasn't until the next month, May of 1984, that the four Gallo papers were published in the prestigious U.S. journal Science. One of the many ironies that was discovered, or one of the many strange features of this whole circumstance that was discovered by John Crutzen, who around the year 2000 published the book Science Fiction's The Dark Legacy of Robert Gallo, the rather delicious subtitle that he used. Crutzen discovered that Montagnier had actually submitted patents for a blood test quite a long time before Robert Gallo, and those patents languished in the patent office, but when Gallo submitted his patent applications, they were processed as quickly as possible, which implies some kind of interference in the patent process, that the U.S. government didn't want Montagnier to get the patent, and they did want Gallo to get the patent. And then a few years later, Ronald Reagan and Jacques Chirac, the presidents of the United States and France, had to have a meeting where they decided that they would give each other partial credit for the discovery of HIV and AIDS. But even after that, more stuff came out that made it clear that Gallo had basically expropriated the work of the Pasteur Institute, Luc Montagnier, and Françoise Barye-Sinoussi. But by that time, it was basically embedded in the minds of North Americans that Robert Gallo was the discoverer. And even when in 2008 the Nobel Prize was awarded to Montagnier and Barye-Sinoussi and snubbed Robert Gallo by not awarding him a joint Nobel, even then people were more confused than anything else. Why wouldn't Gallo have gotten the Nobel Prize when his were the most important papers, the seminal papers that showed that HIV caused AIDS? But what did they actually show? I'll discuss each of the four Gallo papers. I'll try to make this as non-technical as possible. Try to break it down a little bit. One of the papers, entitled Serological Analysis of a Subgroup of Human T Lymphotropic Retroviruses HTLV-3 Associated with AIDS. Now, the name of the virus is actually pretty important, because Gallo claimed to have found two viruses he called HTLV-1 and 2, but he didn't call them lymphotropic viruses. He called them human T-cell leukemia viruses, a lymphocyte cancer. That means that they cause the lymphocytes to expand in a cancerous way, but AIDS was supposed to be a deficiency of the cells, so he subtly changed the name to lymphotropic, attracted to lymphocytes. So viruses, HTLV-1 and 2, make them grow faster, and HTLV-3 kills them. But they're all related. And why was it important that they were related? Because these were gallows viruses. So by calling what we now know as HIV HTLV-3, that was basically saying, this is my property. Some real questions about HTLV-1, because Gallo worked with a group of Japanese scientists on HTLV-1, and the virus kind of went from a joint project to a Gallo-only project over a period of time. HTLV-2 was only ever found in one person, so it was never taken too seriously. But by calling HIV HTLV-3, he was basically saying, I own this. Now, Luc Montagnier called it LAV, and a part of the decision, the consensus between the two competing groups was to give it a new name, HIV, because Gallo wasn't going to let the Pasteur Institute get away with using their name, and they weren't going to let him use his name because of the association of his name with him himself. So in this paper, what did Robert Gallo found? He found some proteins which he called P55 and P24. And the numbers refer to the weight of the proteins. The scientists have a way to separate proteins by weight through the process of chromatography. It's actually a pretty crude process because weight is not the only characteristic of a protein. There's an essentially infinite number of proteins, and many of them will have a similar weight. And proteins that have similar weights cannot really be distinguished. He identified P55 and P24 and P41, and he said extensive accumulation of P24 and P41 occurred in the virus preparation, which is kind of a misnomer because he didn't actually have a virus preparation. He had a cell culture. What Robert Gallo did and what all virologists do is they take a sample from a human or an animal that's supposedly ill with a virus. They add it to a cancerous cell culture. They throw in a bunch of stimulating chemicals and then they see what happens. That's called a virus preparation. They then take a liquid off this cell culture, leaving most of the cancer cells behind, but not all of them because some of them become detached. And then they process the liquid and they call that the pure virus after they maybe centrifuge it, put it through a filter or whatever. It's clearly not pure virus. Protein stains show that these molecules, P24 and P41, are the major components of the virus preparation. P24 and P41 may therefore be considered viral structural proteins. So merely by finding two particular proteins in his cell cultures, he's claiming that these are viral proteins, that they are associated with HTLV-3, and that it is presumably causative of AIDS. He said that these proteins are not detectable in most AIDS patients, but it could be, for example, that these proteins are produced by the disease process that was known as AIDS, was not very well characterized in those days. It doesn't necessarily prove that they belong to a virus that causes the disease process. Let's go to a second paper, which was entitled Frequent Detection and Isolation of Cytopathic Retroviruses from Patients with AIDS and at Risk for AIDS. So here, Robert Gallo had a table where he talked about the ability to culture HTLV-3 from people with AIDS and pre-AIDS. Here we get into a really interesting philosophical question. Robert Gallo was developing a test for HIV. The definition of AIDS is a previously defined disease, such as Kaposi's sarcoma or PCP, plus HIV. But to know if somebody has HIV requires an HIV test. So here we have a chicken and the egg syndrome. How did he determine that people had AIDS when there was no HIV test? How did he know that they didn't just have Kaposi's sarcoma or didn't just have PCP or some other disease? Anyway, he did, in people with pre-AIDS, find the antibodies that he claimed were specific to HTLV-3. He found these in 86% of the people with pre-AIDS, which sounds pretty good. In the clinically normal mothers of juvenile AIDS patients, people he presumably believed had passed the virus on to their children, he found antibodies in 75%. But in people who were actually diagnosed as having AIDS, forgetting for a moment how that's even possible to do in the absence of an HIV test, he only was able to so-called culture the virus in a minority. Juvenile AIDS, 37.5%. Kaposi's sarcoma patients, 30.2%. Adult AIDS with opportunistic infections, 47.6%. And how did he determine that HIV was present? So samples that exhibited more than one of the following were considered positive, according to Gallo. Detection of reverse transcriptase activity, which I'll describe in a moment, in the supernatant fluids, that's the liquids that go over top of the cell culture. Virus observed by electron microscopy, or all you can see with electron microscopy is a particle that looks like it might be a virus. You can't actually tell it's a virus. Intracellular expression of virus-related antigens detected with antibodies from seropositive donors or with rabbit antiserum to HIV. Now, again, this is extremely interesting. How did he know that people were seropositive when he was in the process of developing an HIV test? And how did he get rabbit antiserum to HTLV-3 if he didn't have pure HTLV-3 or HIV to inject into the rabbits to develop the antiserum? So probably what he did is he took blood from HIV-positive people, injected it into the rabbits, found that they developed some antibodies that weren't there before, and declared those to be HIV antibodies. Or he goes on to say the transmission of particles detected by reverse transcriptase assays or by electron microscope observations to fresh human cord blood, bone marrow, or peripheral blood T lymphocytes. So basically he took the supernatant of the cell culture and then he added it to another culture to see whether he could get any particles to be produced. What is reverse transcriptase? Well, HIV is referred to as an RNA virus. And there's two basic types of genetic materials. There's DNA and RNA. DNA is mostly found in our cell nucleus, and the normal process is believed to be that the DNA is copied and produces RNA, which goes out into the main part of the cell, which eventually can result in the production of proteins. So there's a flow of information from DNA to RNA to proteins. The DNA to RNA is called transcription, where a strand of DNA is produced from, a strand of RNA is produced from the DNA. Reverse transcription is supposedly, according to some people, a unique process to retroviruses. Reverse transcription implies that the RNA inserts itself or it produces the DNA, which then gets inserted into your genome. The problem is that it's been known since the very beginning that even normal human cells or cells of other animals contain some reverse transcriptase activity. So it is not exclusively a viral activity. So using the presence of reverse transcriptase to identify the presence of viruses is a very shaky hypothesis indeed. And this is particularly true when you're using an extremely artificial cell culturing system, where all kinds of things can be happening because you're combining cells from a person with AIDS, with cancerous cells, with a bunch of stimulating or toxic chemicals in order to get unusual things to happen. And if one of those unusual things is reverse transcriptase, then you declare, aha, we found a virus. A third paper that the Gallows group found was entitled Detection, Isolation, and Continuous Production of Cytopathic Retroviruses from Patients with AIDS and Pre-AIDS. A third paper from the Robert Gallo group is entitled Detection, Isolation, and Continuous Production of Cytopathic Retroviruses, HDLV3, from Patients with AIDS and Pre-AIDS. And this is really mostly interesting because Gallo wanted to be able to claim that he could continuously produce the virus, even though his mechanism for detecting the virus, the detection of reverse transcriptase in the supernatant of these cell cultures, is highly questionable. But the other thing was that he wanted to use his paper to claim that there were similarities between HDLV1 and HDLV2, which strengthens his claim that this is all the same virus, all the same virus family, and that it really belongs to Robert Gallo. The last of the four papers is entitled Antibodies Reactive with Human T Lymphotropic Retroviruses in the Serum of Patients with AIDS. Now, here, Robert Gallo had claimed a lot more success than with culturing. If you remember, with culturing, he found positive cultures in less than 50% of the people who were diagnosed with AIDS. But in this case, he claimed that patients with AIDS had antibodies 88% of the time. Again, we get to this sort of metaphysical, tautological problem of how do you know that somebody has AIDS if you don't have a test for HIV? Is every gay man with Kaposi's sarcoma by definition an AIDS patient? You've presupposed that they have a viral cause. You've presupposed that the antibodies are the best way to detect it, because you have to admit that the culturing only worked in about half of the cases. You still have about 12% of the patients with so-called AIDS who did not have any antibodies. And what does this mean? Does that mean that 12% of people with clinical AIDS have AIDS caused by another virus? There's just huge logical problems with this. If he had to have an HIV test before he could diagnose AIDS, well, obviously this whole set of research would have been impossible. What should he have done? Well, what Robert Gallo should have done is he should have followed Koch's postulates. Koch's postulates would say that first you purify the virus from somebody who has the illness that you hypothesize is caused by a virus. Then you inject the pure virus into a susceptible organism, which for ethical reasons could not be a human being. And then you determine that the same symptoms or similar symptoms are found in that organism. And then you repurify HIV. Not only has Robert Gallo never accomplished any of these steps, nobody has ever accomplished these steps. I mean, you can't do anything until you purify HIV. Nobody has ever purified HIV. So instead, Robert Gallo relied on an ad hoc definition of AIDS. A gay man with Kaposi's sarcoma or PCP pneumonia was basically AIDS. And then he found antibodies that were more common in those people than in the general population. There's an interesting passage in the book that I mentioned earlier, John Crutzen's Inventing the AIDS Virus, in which the Centers for Disease Control, which wasn't terribly friendly with Robert Gallo, decided to set up a panel to see how good the HIV tests were. And Robert Gallo's tests didn't perform so well. One of the things with an antibody test is that an antibody test, although you're told that you're positive or negative, In actual fact, an antibody test is a continuum. It's a color change or a change in density, optical clarity. And so you have to pick a number, and you say, above this number is positive, below this number is negative. So by moving that line, you can increase and decrease the number of people who test positive or negative. And so Gallo was able to wheedle with the CDC to be able to set the margin of positive versus negative to maximize the number of cases of AIDS that tested positive and the number of cases of people without AIDS who tested negative. And there, by doing that, he was able to get his test approved because the CDC was resistant, whereas Luc Montagnier's test apparently was much more effective. Robert Gallo was able to basically bully his way into getting his test approved. In his paper, Gallo shows what we now know as a Western blot strip. What that is supposed to do is to separate out the viral proteins by weight. As I mentioned earlier, we've got proteins like P24, P41, P51. Those refer to the actual molecular weight of the proteins. The bigger the protein, the heavier the weight. And by separating by weight, you can separate the proteins. And what he shows with the strips is that the majority of cases of AIDS had a band at P41, but one of them most distinctly did not. And one that did have a band was the healthy mother of a child with AIDS. The assumption being that she had antibodies to AIDS, the antibodies to HIV, but what does this mean? If she's healthy and has antibodies to HIV, maybe that means she's fought off the virus. Later, it became dogma that HIV was a deadly, incurable virus, and you couldn't get rid of it, and therefore antibody tests could be usable. If you think about it, an antibody test is a reaction to a virus, and antibodies persist sometimes for years after the virus has gone away. That's basic immunity. So if HIV was believed to be curable, if the body could conquer HIV, then the presence of antibodies would really be meaningless. It would just tell you that, yes, so-and-so was exposed to HIV, but they may have conquered the virus, and if they're healthy, that probably means they don't have it anymore. But in order to characterize AIDS and HIV as a deadly disease, they had to come up with the dogma that once you have HIV, you can never get rid of it, and therefore the antibody tests become meaningful. Because without this assumption, antibody tests wouldn't mean anything. They could not be used to diagnose infection. So what's missing from Gallo's papers? Well, purification of the virus is missing. There was no attempt to purify the virus. There were enormous logical problems, such as the very definition of AIDS, which clearly requires the detection of HIV before you can classify something as AIDS, because there is not a single disease that's ever been called AIDS or become a component of AIDS that isn't known in people that don't have HIV and aren't classified as AIDS. So the definition of AIDS without an HIV test is meaningless, but in order for Gallo to publish his paper, he had to define people with AIDS, or he couldn't have developed his HIV test. So Gallo's papers were essentially a tautology, or circular reasoning, by arbitrarily saying these people have AIDS, then doing a test, and then maybe saying, well, gee, these people with classical AIDS who didn't test positive on my test, well, they obviously don't have the virus, so they're not really AIDS, so we'll get rid of them. So then we have 100% correlation between HIV and AIDS, which is totally artificial. And then to go out into the general population, this was perhaps the biggest crime of all, to go out into the general population and say we're going to test everybody, and everybody who tests positive is infected with a virus and is going to die of AIDS if we don't do anything about it. That was probably the biggest crime. At first, it wasn't so bad. They said we need to protect the blood supply because they believed there was a blood-borne virus. They hadn't proved it, but they believed it. So it wasn't unreasonable to use an HIV test on the blood supply. If the blood tested positive, don't use it. If you throw away 1% of the blood and you're wrong, then all you've done is wasted some blood. But if you take the same tests and go to those people who tested positive and say, you have a deadly virus, you've crossed the line when you haven't actually proved anything about HIV and AIDS. And although one could say, well, Gallo's research is not really reliable, the government investigations into Robert Gallo that occurred in the late 80s and throughout the 90s showed tremendous problems with Gallo's research, then we could rely on Luc Montagnier. Luc Montagnier is on record as saying that he never purified HIV. He's on record as contradicting all the major dogmas of HIV. He says that the body can eliminate HIV within a few weeks if you have a healthy immune system. He's called AIDS a disease of oxidative stress. He's promoted therapies that reverse oxidative stress, although he's very careful not to say that they could be used in AIDS. It certainly seems logical that there would be therapies for AIDS that weren't antiretroviral drugs. So you really have to rely on Gallo's research as the origin of the dogma for HIV and AIDS. And even 30 years later, they still have this enormous power in the scientific community because people don't want to go into them and try to criticize them. To emphasize the weakness of Gallo's research, let me quote him himself in one of these four papers. Evidence for the presence of HTLV-3 or HIV in the cell cultures included 1. Viral reverse transcriptase activity in the supernatant fluids. That's the fluids that are over top of the cancerous cells that form the basis of the cell culture. As I pointed out, reverse transcriptase is not unique to viruses, and in any case, it doesn't prove that a single particular virus is present. 2, transmission of virus by co-culturing T cells. But again, it's not really transmission of virus because he never at any point actually detects virus. He's basically just pushing these other methods of detection down the line. 3, observation of virus by electron microscope. Well, you can't observe virus by electron microscope. You can observe particles that are the size and shape that you expect, but that doesn't prove that they're a virus. And in fact, when in I think around 1997, there were two papers published in a virology journal that looked at what people had been calling pure virus for over 10 years, and they declared that the vast majority of the material were what they called microvesicles. The difference between microvesicles and virus under an electron microscope is very difficult to determine. They're both spherical particles with a membrane around them. You can tell that you've got microvesicles because the particles vary dramatically in size. If you had virus, they would all be exactly the same size. And because when they observed this material, the particles varied dramatically in size, they knew that they were not dealing with pure materials. And if all of this research has been based on concentrating the supernatant of cell cultures, which never had pure virus in them, then all of this AIDS research from Gallo on forwards is meaningless. In the time remaining, let me quote a little bit from John Crutzen's book, was published in 2002, the full title being Science Fictions, A Scientific Mystery, A Massive Cover-Up, and The Dark Legacy of Robert Gallo. It amazes me to this day that Robert Gallo never sued over what was in this book because it's so damning. Somebody described the book in a review as saying, the revelations in this book are startling. A malevolent autocrat, he's referring to Robert Gallo here, and his little fiefdom perched at the top of the biomedical hierarchy, burning with obsession for a Nobel Prize. and rivals sabotaging each other's work, stealing credit from subordinates. Superiors at the National Institute of Health and other institutions allow these top scientists to act with impunity, ensuring that their pronouncements, no matter how unlikely, are received as gospel by credulous scientists and doctors below them in the pecking order that is big science. John Crutzen talked about the investigations into Robert Gallo's potential misconduct. He says, the federal misconduct regulations hadn't required the Office of Scientific Integrity or the Office of Research Integrity, which are U.S. government offices, to produce evidence of intent to deceive on the part of Gallo or Popovich. Popovich was his right-hand man. Only that they had published fabricated data or statements. But as the date for the Popovich hearing approached, the Human Health Services Department Appeals Board abruptly raised the bar. No longer would it be enough to demonstrate that the questioned items in Popovich's paper were false. Unless the Office of Research Integrity could prove Popovich intended to mislead his readers, and moreover that his intentional deceptions had adverse consequences for the scientific community, the appeals board would dismiss all the misconduct findings against him. So what this meant was that as the misconduct hearings against Gallo and Popovich went forward, the government reacted by changing the rules so that they couldn't find Popovich and Gallo guilty. And so although Gallo was found at one point to be guilty of scientific misconduct, the finding was later withdrawn because it basically became impossible to prove what was going on inside Gallo's head. Talking about the antibody tests, if the French intended to use the CDC to prove that they had found the cause of AIDS, Gallo would do the same. And this was the testing process that I talked to, where they sent some tests. They took some samples from the CDC, they tested them and reported back which ones were positive. 72% of the Pasteur Institutes were positive, but only 48% of Gallo's AIDS patients. Now, even the Pasteur Institute results are not exactly stunning, because that still leaves 28% of the samples with incorrect results. Gallo thought that the CDC should allow him to change his borderline results to positive. So that means that he could move the cutoff of positive-negative cutoff one way or the other. Pasteur Institute, on the other hand, hadn't asked to change any of its results after the fact, and Don Francis of the CDC was against allowing Gallo that extra advantage. However, Jim Curran at the CDC agreed to Gallo's request. Now Gallo and the French each scored 92% of the pre-AIDS patients positive. Among AIDS patients, the French had gotten 80% right to Gallo's 78%. This reminds me a lot of the current Volkswagen diesel pollution scandal, where if you can manipulate the test, if you can't pass the test, you can manipulate it and get something to appear to be right that's not. Another really incredible document that was uncovered by John Crutzen was a draft of one of the four seminal Gallo papers that had been written by Popovich, who I had mentioned was Gallo's right-hand man. Now, Popovich knew that the lab was in big trouble with all of the investigations into scientific fraud, so he sent a copy of this paper with Gallo's handwritten remarks on it to his sister, who lived in somewhere in Europe. And the remarks that Gallo wrote are quite incredible. He scratched out half the abstract, and he said, "The abstract is rather trivial for a putative breakthrough proper for the journal Science." So he's basically saying, look, if we're going to get this in Science, we have to basically have claimed to have found the cause of AIDS. We can't have all this waffling about this maybe, it might be. And talking in very scientific technical terms about characterizing this virus. We have to be much more specific than that. So he basically rewrote the paper which Popovich had been quite careful about, to make claims that really were not supported by the data. And luckily, Crutzen was able to get a copy, so it's now preserved for posterity, with Gallo's handwriting all over it. Comments like, Mika, that was Popovich's first name, you are crazy. When he didn't write something that was strong enough for Gallo. Another really incredible document that John Crutzen uncovered into his research was a letter to Mika Popovich, the right-hand man of Robert Gallo, from Matthew Gonda, who was a top electron microscopist, on March 26th, 1984. Now, you'll recall that the press conference was in April 1984, and the publication of Gallo's papers was in May 1984. So by March, everything should have been wrapped up. This is the entire letter. Dear Mika, I am sending you four extra copies of results requested by Betsy Reed. She said Dr. Gallo wanted these micrographs for publication because they contained HTLV particles. If this assumption is based on the cultures being antigen positive, I would like to point out that the so-called particles in micrograph 0905 are in debris of a degenerated cell. No other extracellular, quote, virus-like particles were observed free between cells anywhere in the pellet. The small extracellular vesicles in graph 0904 are at least 50% smaller than HTLV mature particles seen in type 1, 2, or 3. Again, these vesicles can be found in any cell pellet. I do not believe that any of the particles photographed are HTLV 1, 2, or 3. So this is a month before Robert Gallo declared that he'd found the probable cause of AIDS, and about less than 2 months before he published four papers that became the foundation of the HIV-AIDS theory in the journal Science. I hope this has given you cause to think about the scientific foundation of the HIV-AIDS theory. I would like to say that I appreciate everybody who's listening to The Infectious Myth. Send me your feedback. Tell me what you like. Tell me what you don't like. Send me ideas for new topics, new guests. I really appreciate everybody who listens to this radio show and podcast. I particularly appreciate it if you recommend it to other people. And as I've mentioned before, if there's anybody who would like to sponsor The Infectious Myth, please let me know. And for now, goodbye.